This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Colombian author Juan Gabriel Vazquez is best known for his novel, The Sound of Things Falling. Before his novels were published, he has several. He earned degrees in law and Latin American literature, worked as a translator, and wrote political columns for publications in Colombia, London, and Madrid. I caught up with him via Skype from Bogota, Colombia, to talk about his novel, Reputations, which will be released in paperback next week. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Reputations takes place in Bogota, Colombia, and the main character, Javier Mayarino, is a political cartoonist on his way to be recognized for 40 years of work in the field. And I really loved the way you describe his work as a moral authority for half of the country, public enemy number one for the other half. What prompted you to choose a political cartoonist as your main character?
The origin of the novel is, I guess, my lifelong interest in this other cartoonist who was a sort of classic of the genre in Colombia, called Ricardo Rendon. Ricardo Rendon was very powerful, very well-respected and feared even in the 20s. And at the beginning of the 30s, he went into this shop. He sat down, he ordered a beer, and he shot himself in the head. And nobody has ever been able to figure out why. I grew up with this mystery because my father in particular loved the work of Ricardo Rendon. And I grew up with his cartoons, surrounded by his cartoons, by his published books, not understanding too much of what they said because they discussed the politics of the 20s in Colombia, which I didn't know that well. But I grew up with this sort of relationship with the legend of his suicide, with his cartoons and his work as a cartoonist. And when I began writing this novel, I realized I was going probably to throw into the novel many of my neuroses as a political columnist in Colombia, but I would use the figure of a cartoonist, not a columnist, to make them surface.
So you're a political columnist?
I was a weekly political columnist for 7 years. I wrote for a Colombian newspaper called El Espectador, which is the most liberal of the two main Colombian newspapers. I stopped some years ago because my new novel was demanding too much of my time. But all this time, I have continued writing occasional columns, not only for Colombia, but for The Guardian in London, for El País in Madrid, discussing important issues around many things, but particularly around the subject that has been obsessing us Colombians for the last 5 years, the peace negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla.
I know in the United States, there seems to be a great divide and political opinion becomes so personal. And there was a section in the book where you describe Mayarino's daily routine, specifically a cleansing routine, where in the shower he was able to rid himself of critiques from the previous day and from opinions that should have seemed only idiotic, but actually struck him as criminal. And that's in quotes. Are you struck by the polar nature of politics in so many countries?
Yes, this is something that I find predictable on one hand and very disquieting on the other. I think we have reached a level of polarization in our contemporary societies that we had never seen before in my lifetime. I live in a very politicized country in which political opinion can involve violence. I have known journalists my whole life who have fled the country because they get death threats. I have known journalists that have been murdered because of their journalistic work. So this has been going on all my life as a conscious citizen and as a reader. But I had never seen what is going on right now in Colombia, mainly around the peace process. It worries me to see that the same symptoms are present all over the world. I believe the defeat of the Colombian peace referendum that was supposed to approve the peace agreements in October of last year was part of the same movement, of the same crisis of the truth of the same inability on our side, the citizens, to agree on the same version of reality that led to Brexit in the UK and probably to the election of Donald Trump in America. So this is, I think, something that is going on all over the world. These are polarized societies that have allowed political debate to become simplified and violent in many senses.
When he was receiving his recognition, Mairino said that in the 40 years of drawing political cartoons, two things hadn't changed: what worries us and what makes us laugh. Talk a little bit about what he meant by that.
Of course, he says these words in the middle of this speech he is giving while being honored by the Colombian establishment and by Colombian politicians. I see that speech as a little moment of arrogance on the side of Mairino, in which, all the same, he manages to convey certain principles about his work. And one of those principles is the power of humor. This is essential in the work of a cartoonist. This is the reason cartoonists are powerful all over the world, and particularly in the Colombian case, I think I can safely say this. They're powerful because they deal in humor, because humor is subversive. Humor is one of the things politicians fear the most, and powerful people in general fear the most. I wrote this novel, I published this novel in Spanish in 2013. It came out the following year in France. And when I went to discuss it in France, in my conversations with readers, journalists, everybody wanted to know how was it possible that cartoonists who just make jokes could be so powerful in a country such as mine and so feared and vulnerable to hatred and death threats. And a few months later, there was the tragedy of the murder of the Charlie Hebdo journalists, in which Islamic fundamentalists killed a whole newspaper, including cartoonists, because of what they had drawn. This tense relationship between humor and power is still alive. Humor is still feared by powerful people, and it's still a weapon of criticism and discussion that remains able to say things that you could never say seriously.
You know, along those same lines, another statement that Mairino, another statement of his that struck me as noteworthy was when he said, and I quote, "Caricatures might exaggerate reality, but they can't invent it. They can distort, but never lie." And I assume he was referring to, you know, like physical attributes, but aren't the captions that carry the tone so subjective?
Yes, probably, probably. This is actually one of my favorite sentences in the book because it's not mine.
Oh.
It belongs to one of my sources, a very well-respected political cartoonist right now in Colombia, who signs his cartoons as Vlado. He was one of my sources, and he became a good friend of mine over the many interviews and the many hours he dedicated to illustrating me about the nature of his job, his fears, his shortcomings, everything he had learned from his trade. And one of the things that he felt really strongly was this, that cartoonists, for all the time they spend making fun, really, of public figures, in that way sending critical messages about the political situation, they don't lie. Cartoons never lie because humor never lies. It exaggerates, it can be guilty of distortion, but there's no real cartoon that doesn't have one foot in reality. So as political opinion goes in our time, in which you can make things up, lie all the time, tell calumnies and misinformations, cartoons are a very strange source of truth. There's always some kind of truth at the base of a cartoon, and this is why they have become valuable forms of political discussion in many countries.
Words can be twisted and can have double meaning, and things can be hidden in the words. And there was one instance in the book where he was talking to a young woman, and he said, And this is another quote, "The things I draw become more comprehensible, more easily assimilated." And I think that the drawing has the ability to, you know, picture worth a thousand words. And that has the ability to reach so many people on so many different levels. But then later, to his ex-wife, he said, "They need someone to tell them what to think." To which she replied, "People already know what they think. People already have their prejudices well formed. They only want someone in authority to confirm their prejudices." Did Majorino understand the weight of his opinions?
Ah, that's a very good question. Probably he didn't know, and this is one of his predicaments. The whole novel is an exploration of these questions, so I'm very glad you put this one up to me, because the novel is a meditation about our relationship as what we could call opinion makers, our relationship with this power we have. Political cartoonists such as Majorino, political columnists such as many, many that I know, that I read, both in my country and in other countries. I don't think we quite grasp the extent to which our words and our drawings matter to people. And this is a sort of distance that opens up between somebody who writes in the papers or who draws cartoons in the paper and his public. He's never able to really grasp the influence he has, I think. And this is something I experienced as a columnist. And I also experienced the other thing you were mentioning, the idea that the reason readers read a particular columnist or a particular newspaper, it's not to form their own opinion about things. It's to confirm through prestigious words or through the prestige of the printed page what they already think. And this is something worrying about our democracies. People are never really trying to reach some sort of conviction, an objective truth about contentious issues. They want their prejudices to be put into words. And I think this is one of our shortcomings as citizens.
To me, a subtle subject in the book was suicide. And I remember three instances anyway. And the first was the one you mentioned of the political cartoonist whose name I cannot pronounce because I cannot roll my R's.
That's okay.
And the second was, the second one mentioned was the poet. Is it Jose Asuncion Silva? Is that how you pronounce it?
Silva, that's right. Yes, I had forgotten about his,
and
his presence in the book.
He asked the doctor to draw a circle around his heart and then later shot himself there. And you made me actually go look it up to see if it was a real case. And yes, it was.
Yes.
And then the third, though, was one of Majorino's subjects whose reputation was ruined as a result of the cartoon. Or, I mean, that's one argument. It could be argued that he ruined his own reputation. But Majorino didn't strike me as suicidal. But because of these instances were mentioned, I wonder if it ever crossed his mind.
Well, I wonder the same thing. Yes. I don't think it does. No, I don't think Majorino has any kind of suicidal tendencies. He has too high an opinion of himself, and this is one of his defects, to consider suicide. In a way, the novel tries to explore his very difficult, very tense relationship with his own position in the world. And it begins at a moment in which Majorino is as high as you can get in Colombian society. His importance, his prestige, his reputation in Colombian society is as high as it can get. And the novel, in a sense, is a tragedy, in that it tries to trace his downfall. This is what I realized I was doing halfway through the writing of the novel, tracing this powerful man's downfall. I don't know that it ends in suicide. Probably after the last page, he may consider something like that. But you're right, suicide is something that permeates the novel. There are three instances of this, and particularly the center of the book. The center of the book is the question about this congressman's suicide. What did Majorino or his cartoons have to do with it? Is it possible? It's a question that is asked in the novel, I think, more than once. Is it possible to ruin, really, somebody's life with a drawing? These are questions that haunt the characters. And particularly, this man's suicide is important for Majorino because even if the novel started for me as an exploration of the vulnerability of our public image, after a certain point, it became something very different. It became an exploration of the vulnerability of our private memories. Because what happens in the book is that Mayarino tries to remember what he saw 28 years before that led him to draw this very damaging cartoon. And he realizes he probably didn't see what he thinks he saw. And that leads to a whole lot of questions about memory, about what tricks memory plays on us, and about the relationship between our certainties and the power we have when we deal with somebody else's image and reputation.
Your prose is so very visual, and there were a couple of instances where I could see the image so vividly. On page 179, at least in my copy, it's on page 179, you wrote, "She was waiting for him. Her posture had the steadied inattention of waiting bodies. Everyone who waits knows or thinks they might be seen at any moment, seen by the person they're waiting to meet, and their gestures, their mannerisms, the position of their legs, and straightness of their back is never the same as it would be were they not waiting." And another description you wrote on page 142, you wrote, "In his imagination, Valencia was one of those 19th century caricatures where the person appears covered in question marks and with an intense expression of confusion. And then he imagined Valencia's head converted into a silhouette, a black line, and those three words, 'she doesn't remember,' banging against the line, 'desperate flies in a glass box.'" How do you flesh out your characters so thoroughly? Because, you know, it's one thing to describe this woman who's waiting, but then to get into the mind of Mayarino as a cartoonist and to imagine how he would envision the world around him, I mean, how do you do that as a writer?
Well, this was, thank you for noticing that. This was one of the special challenges of this book, realizing that I would be using for a whole novel the point of view of somebody who doesn't deal in words as much as in images. So I had to make my own prose rely more on images than on ideas or other kinds of description. This is our point of view as readers is Mayarino. It is through his eyes that we see the novel, that we see the things that happen in the novel. So I had to make it very graphic. I had to look at the world in the way a cartoonist would look at the world. And from what I learned, what I have learned, and what I can imagine, these are people who look at the world differently than the rest of us, as they should, and as should be the case, I imagine, with visual artists of any kind. They look at the world in images, and they deal with images. So I had to write a different kind of prose, I think, than the rest of my novels, in that it had to be made with images, out of very visual situations. The challenge of this is that it's also a novel that deals with themes. The characters think about things all the time. They think about memory. They think about reputations. They think about the themes of the book. So I had to find ways in which writing in images could also be a way of discussing the abstract ideas and the abstract themes of the book. And this is the power of metaphor. This is what metaphors are for. So it's a book filled with metaphors of many kinds. And really, it was an exercise in style in that way that took me a lot of time.
Now, this book was written originally in Spanish, and I read a translation. Is it odd to talk about these lines that I found so remarkable in English? Is it odd to talk about them? Because I would note specific lines, and I found myself wondering, how would the original sentence read? I'm reading these things back to you in English, and that's not how you originally wrote them.
No, and that's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating for me. I've been discussing this novel in its English translation for many years now. For a couple of years. And it takes me a little bit of time to realize that I'm discussing somebody else's words. And that I love these words. These words are very, very good. I have the extreme luck of counting on one of the best translators in the world from Spanish to English, Anne McLean. And we are close. We work closely together. So I witnessed the birth of my story in her words. And it's a wonderful thing to watch. We choose to change things together to make them better than the literal translation would be. So it's an amazing thing, translation. It's really a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, when we think about it, we're all influenced. I know American writers, for instance, are hugely influenced by, let's say, Chekhov, a Russian short story writer, and they don't read Russian, and I don't read Russian. And Chekhov and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky have shaped our ideas about literature and probably the way we see the world. Now, the same happens with Greek, or I don't know, you name it. So it's a fascinating thing, translation. And as I say, I'm very lucky to be in Anne MacLean's hands.
Now, you yourself are a translator. Do you find that after being translated yourself, that that has helped you become a better translator for others?
Well, I used to be a translator.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I earned a living as a translator once upon a time. I no longer have to do that. Translation is not as well paid as it should be in Spanish, but I still do very occasionally, from time to time, a book that I absolutely love, and I do it as a labor of love. For instance, I have just finished a new translation into Spanish of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is one of my favorite books in the world. And the experience of turning that prose into Spanish was extremely difficult, fascinating again, and it also taught me a lot of things. I think that one of the best ways to learn how to write fiction is to translate, because nobody reads as well as a translator. A translator is the perfect reader of a book, and in that sense, he learns everything there is to be learned from a book. And yes, I would say that this translation of Heart of Darkness, which I finished just some months ago, benefited enormously from my conversations with Anne MacLean and the things she has taught me about her trade.
I was doing some prep work, and I was reading an interview that you gave to the New York Times by the book section back in 2015. And I mean, you're incredibly well-read. You're so well-read. But one of the questions was about the piece of work that formed you as a writer, and you said the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
What language did you read that in?
In English.
In English. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I started reading Shakespeare with this kind of passion when I was 20, probably. I had read Shakespeare in school, but when I was 20, I was in the middle of my law studies. And there was an hour of commuting between my house and my university. And I found that the best way to spend that time was with the Royal Shakespeare Company's versions of the tragedies in audiobook. So I spent all this time listening to, you know, Kenneth Branagh and Judi Dench and all these wonderful, amazing actors perform Shakespeare on tape. And it would be very long to explain what Shakespeare did to me, but really it was the first time that I was so aware of the possibilities of language, of creating characters, the things you can discuss through fiction. And I think this is one of the reasons I like so much this family of novels that have inherited from Shakespeare and from tragedy rather than from Cervantes and from comedy. I mean, Dostoevsky and Faulkner, these are Shakespearean novelists. These are novelists with a very strong sense of tragedy, a tragical vision of life, and of language. These are people that have stayed with me. Faulkner is one of the most important novelists for my vocation.
That was Juan Gabriel Vazquez, author of the book Reputations, which was published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or on iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.